So as always then, let's begin with a quick review of what we covered last time. First of all, the defeat of Saul's army by the Philistines at the Battle of Gilboa, and the deaths of Saul and three of his sons. And then David's reaction when he learns of that defeat, of those deaths. And then following that, David's second anointing, this one over the tribe of Judah. Judah only, we would think, but also likely over the tribe of Levi, who were, I think most of the Levites were over with the tribe of Judah at the time. And then we introduced, or God's word introduced, Saul's powerful and ambitious Benjamite cousin and general Abner, who took measures to place Saul's surviving son Ish-bosheth on the throne of the other non-Jewish tribes of Israel. And then we finished last week in 2 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 10. You'll be turning there if you like. We finished there where we read that. I'll just repeat what it says there. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. So now as we move into this, we might ask the question, why did Ish-bosheth only reign for 2 short years? We'll find that as we go along. But for now, let's continue with our history then. And just to, as I mentioned here, when I look back over my notes, I see that today's episode is something of a character study. A character study of four men: Ish-bosheth, his general Abner, David, and David's general Joab, all come very significantly into our study today. So here we are in 2 Samuel chapter 2, beginning now with verse 11. 2 Samuel chapter 2 verse 11, and the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah, Judah only, along with the Levites of course, was 7 years and 6 months. 7.5 years. Of course, once David took over the rulership of all the other tribes, he was king much longer than that. But before that, it specifies here that he was just over Judah and Levi for 7.5 years. Verse 12. And Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim. Okay, they'd gone to Mahanaim as a kind of place of safety, safety from the Philistines and safety from David as well. And also perhaps for Abner to complete the formulation of his ambitious plans. Second half of verse 12 here, from Mahanaim to Gibeon. Okay, and by the way, Ish-bosheth himself was left behind in Mahanaim when Abner and his men went up to Gibeon. Now Gibeon had been Saul's capital city. It was the location of Saul's royal palace. And so this return to Saul's capital was a strategically significant move by Abner. It was a kind of power play, a power play which spoke volumes. But next came another somewhat bizarre event. A bizarre event which took place when some of David's men also arrived at Gibeon, along with Joab, perhaps to negotiate peace talks, or perhaps, if necessary, to fight for David to take the throne. Okay, verse 13. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon. Now, let's just dig into this a little bit. This Zeruiah was one of David's sisters, and that would make Joab, we're introduced to Joab now here for the first time, and he becomes a very significant person from here on in. And in this next section of our history, well, Joab was David's nephew, okay? And Joab was the powerful, warlike, influential top general of David's army. So Joab was the exact equivalent of his nemesis, Abner. And Abner was, of course, over Saul's armies and Ish-bosheth's armies. Now, verse 13 here says that they went out. In other words, David's army went out from their former location at Hebron, and they marched up to Gibeon, which was 24 miles to the north. So they marched to Hebron in order to meet Abner. It says they met together. They went up there to meet Abner, Ish-bosheth, not Ish-bosheth, because he wouldn't have been there, and the other non-Jewish Israelites. Although Joab only had one tribe of fighting men with him, and of course the Israelites had more, Judah, as we've seen before, was a very numerous and powerful and warlike tribe. And of course, above all, the Lord God was on the side of David and Joab and the Jews. So they had the Lord's multiple prophetic promises to rely upon. His prophetic promises regarding the establishment of the whole united Israelite kingdom under the Jewish kings and initially under David. So, as they had the Lord's power and providence to trust in, they went out boldly to meet the armies of Israel under Abner. Now, when the scripture here says that they met together, the Hebrew implies that at first the generals of the two armies met for a parley, for a peace talk, rather than in an immediate warlike meeting of their two armies. It mentions here the pool of Gibeon. And at first reading, we might think of this pool of Gibeon as just a small, insignificant pond, perhaps a decorative pond at the late Saul's palace. But my favourite Bible commentator, John Gill, suggests that it might have been the same as Jeremiah called the great waters that are in Gibeon. He says that in Jeremiah chapter 41 and verse 12. You don't have to turn there. The great waters that are in Gibeon. And also, I looked it up there, and according to archaeological findings, this pool of Gibeon was actually a man-made well. And it was a very deep and quite wide well at that. When it says pool in the Hebrew, the word is brekha, B-R-E-K-H-A-H, and it means reservoir, which is a very accurate description. The remains of the ancient town of Gibeon were excavated by a team of archaeologists in the 1950s and 1960s, and the pool of Gibeon itself was unearthed in 1957, and it was found to be what the archaeologists said was one of the ancient world's remarkable engineering achievements. You can actually find excellent photographs of it on the internet there, and it was dug 88 feet down into the limestone until it met the water table, and it's 37 feet or 11.3 meters wide. Now, that's pretty wide, and they carved a spiral staircase down and along its walls, which allowed access to the water and whatever the water level was at any given time. Just an amazing thing. And again, look up the the photos on the internet, and it is just a wonderful piece of ancient engineering. Okay, continuing, still in verse 13. And they sat down, the one on the one side of the pool, Joab on one side of the pool and his men, and the other on the other side of the pool. So you can imagine that the two generals, backed up by their armies, facing each other, watching each other's motions, and perhaps, you know, trying to stare one another down. But then Abner broke the uneasy silence with this very strange, bizarre suggestion. Verse 14, and Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men now arise and play before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." And there arose and went over by number 12 of Benjamin, which pertained to Ish-bosheth the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. So the idea, when you read it, a really strange situation, but it would seem to have been for a kind of wrestling match, and maybe to decide the differences of the two sides. And you think about that, it's really not such a bad idea. You think about what's going on right now, and wouldn't it be nice if, rather than bringing the world close to the brink of nuclear war, that Putin and Zelensky each chose 12 of their best men to fight it out and decide their differences. Pipe dream, of course. But anyway, this fight, this wrestling match, turns much more violent than a mere wrestling match. Verse 16, and they caught every one his fellow or his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his fellow's side. So they fell down together, wherefore that place was called Helkath Hazurim, which means smooth rock. I'm not sure what the implication there is. Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon. Now, some Bible scholars have written that only Abner's 12 were killed, but the grammar rather indicates that all 24 died there. And if that's so, there would have been a stalemate. And if there was a stalemate, the differences were not resolved. And what happened? A battle ensued, verse 17. And there was a very sore battle that day. And Abner was beaten. He was beaten. He wasn't killed, though, as we're going to see. And the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So here we see, for the very first time, but certainly not the last time, the house of Judah was at war officially with the other tribes of Israel. Case, you know, we'd had Saul chasing David and his Jews before, but here we have Judah and the other tribes of Israel, say, officially at war. And this once again proves that the point that although all true Jews are Israelites, all Israelites are not Jews. Okay, you get the point. The next verses describe the flight of the recently beaten Israelite army, and specifically their general, Abner, who was hotly pursued by Joab's brother, Asahel. And we won't go through all of the detail of that, but Abner tricked Asahel and turned round and killed him. Jump down to verse 24, please. Joab also, and Abishai was Asahel's other brother, pursued after Abner, and the sun went down when they were come to the hill of Ammah that lies before Giah by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. Now, it's interesting here, you've got the Jews now are chasing the Israelites, so it's kind of ironic that the late Saul's pursuers of David now became the pursued. Okay, so the hunters became the hunted. verse 25. And the children of Benjamin gathered themselves together after Abner, in support of Abner, and became one troop and stood on the top of a hill. Then Abner, the wily, sweet-talking trickster, called out to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Know you not that it will be bitterness in the latter end? How long shall it be then before you bid the people," the people, David's Jewish forces, "how long shall it be before you bid the people return from following their brethren," in other words, the remnants of Abner's mainly Benjamite army? And Joab said, and this is kind of ambiguous the way it's worded here, and Joab said, "As God lives, unless you had spoken, surely then in the morning the people," my army, Joab saying, "had gone up everyone from following his brother, the Benjamites." So Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people of David's Jewish army, stood still and pursued after Israel, after Abner's Benjamites, no more, neither fought they any more. For a while anyway. Nevertheless, as we're soon going to see, the animosity between the two groups was certainly not over. And nor had Joab forgiven, nor forgotten what Abner had done to his brother. Verse 29. And Abner and his men walked all that night through the plain and passed over Jordan and went through all Bithron, and they came to Mahanaim. Mahanaim was where Abner had left his weakling puppet king Ish-bosheth. He left him there. It's interesting that when there was fighting to be done, Saul had left Ish-bosheth back home, and here Abner left Ish-bosheth back at Mahanaim. I don't know why, but he was such a weakling that he probably would have, changed things. So anyway, verse 30. And Joab returned from following Abner, and when he had gathered all the people of his army together, there lacked of David's servants only 19 men, and Asahel, of course. But the servants of David had smitten of Benjamin and of Abner's men, in other words, of the other Israelite tribes, so that 360 men died. And they, Joab's Jews, took up Asahel and buried him in the sepulchre of his father, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron at the break of day. That's where David was. David had stayed back in Hebron, we believe. So on we go now into chapter 3, still in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 1. Now there was long war again. Just because that skirmish, that small battle was over, the long war continued. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. So again, the animosity between the Jews and the other Israelites continued for a long time, and perhaps as long as 5 years. And still, so there was war. And as often happens, yes, even in times of war, there were some activities that continued as normal. Verse 2. And unto David were sons born in Hebron. And his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. And his second, Kileab of Abigail, the wife of Nabal, or the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephatiah, the sons of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream, by Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. Okay, that's six sons, but there were lots more. The number of David's sons mentioned by name in the Bible is a whopping 19. And in addition, there's two other unnamed sons that are recorded as having been born in Jerusalem. One, but probably both, had died in infancy. And one of these was the first child born of David's adulterous relationship with Bathsheba. We'll come all to that, to all of that later on. And only one of David's daughters is mentioned by name, and that was Tamar. We need to keep these names of David's sons in the backs of our memories because they're so very important to our continuing history of the Jews, and especially as concerns the Jews' royal lineage and of the two lineages of Jesus. So it's good to be familiar with those names. We're going to come back to them. And some of those sons were, you don't hear much more about them, but some of them were just pains in the neck. You know, they were real stumbling blocks to David and to his monarchy. Okay, verse 6. And it came to pass, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner made himself strong for the house of Saul. Made himself strong. Apparently Abner had no real loyalty to the house of Saul, and certainly not to the contemptible weakling Ish-bosheth, but only to his own ambitious self. So before long, an inevitable row blew up between Abner and Ish-bosheth. Verse 7. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ish-bosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" We know what he was supposed to have done there. As you know, we find similar accounts as this elsewhere in the scriptures. And this kind of certainly potentially risky act was somewhat common with men who were trying to usurp a leader's power and authority. And if you just bookmark 2 Samuel chapter 3 there, and just go to 2 Samuel chapter 16. But just let me briefly quote one other example from much later in our history, when David's son Absalom was rebelling against him and trying to usurp his power, David's power. So just see what happened here. 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse 21. And Ahithophel was a treacherous one of David's counselors, said unto Absalom, David's son, "Go in unto your father's concubines, which he has left to keep house, and all Israel shall hear that you are abhorred of your father. And then shall the hands of all that are with you be strong." You can see what was happening. This act, this going into the leaders or the king's concubines, it was seen as an act of rebellion and usurpation, I guess, of the king's power. Anyway, let's go back to chapter 3, please. Back to 2 Samuel chapter 3. And I don't know, it doesn't actually say whether or not Abner actually did what Ish-bosheth accused him of here. It's certainly quite possible, considering Abner's ambitious nature. And although Abner did not actually deny it, if he had done it, he now hid his guilt by putting on a show of anger. Verse 8. 2 Samuel chapter 3 verse 8. Then was Abner very wroth for the words of Ish-bosheth, and said, "Am I a dog's head, which against Judah to show kindness this day unto the house of Saul your father, to his brethren and to his friends, and have not delivered you, Ish-bosheth, into the hand of David, that you charge me today with a fault concerning this woman?" Didn't actually deny that he'd done it. "So do God to Abner, and more also, except as the Lord has sworn to David, even so I do to him." Again, puffing out his chest in vanity. Verse 10, "To translate the kingdom from the house of Saul, and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan even to Beersheba, even so I do to him." Is that power-hungry, ambitious Abner again? So in this statement, what we see here is an implied and veiled suggestion that if he, Abner, did not get his own way with Ish-bosheth, Abner might transfer his loyalties over to David, taking his army with him, and which is actually what, in effect, he did. He actually did. Verse 11. "And he, Ish-bosheth, could not answer Abner a word again, because he feared him." Again, what we see here is the contrast between the power of Abner and the weakness of Ish-bosheth, even though Ish-bosheth was the king and Abner was merely the general. Verse 12, "And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf." On whose behalf? Ish-bosheth's behalf or Abner's own behalf? Well, likely, nominally and formally on Ish-bosheth's behalf, as we'll see, but really the wily, untrustworthy Abner was probably doing this to achieve his own ambitious ends. Still in verse 12, "saying to David, whose is the land? Saying also, make your league with me." With me, this is coming from Abner now when it goes up there. "And behold, my hand shall be with you to bring about all Israel unto you." So let's remember though here that without Abner and his armies, Ish-bosheth was nothing but a powerless royal figurehead. Verse 13. "And he," David, "said, well, agreed, I will make a league with you, Ish-bosheth, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face except you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." And David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son. Again, this was a king-to-king thing. The messengers did not go to Abner, they went king to king, saying, "Deliver me my wife Michal, which I espoused to me for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, even from Phaltiel the son of Laish, and her husband Phaltiel went with her along, weeping behind her, to Bahurim. And then said Abner unto him, unto Phaltiel, "Go, return, take a hike, you wimp." And he returned. So David's first wife, Michal, was returned to him as he demanded. Look at that. And we know what Michal was like. Why did David bring her back? I'm not totally sure. I'm thinking perhaps as a kind of punishment on Michal, but also perhaps posthumously as a punishment on her late father Saul for what he'd done, for giving Michal to another man. But even though David was so loved and blessed and guided by the Lord God, and I certainly have no right to judge David, I'm not totally sure that every one of David's decisions and actions, and especially those not mentioned as being guided by the Lord, and perhaps even more especially those relating to women, that those decisions and actions were all good, sensible decisions. I'm not sure of that. And as we'll see in future episodes of our study, the continuing relationship between David and Michal certainly was not a very positive one. But okay, let's get back. Let's leave Michal for now and let's get back to the wily Abner in verse 17. And Abner had communication with the elders of Israel, and again this is non-Jewish Israel, saying, "Are you sought for David in times past to be king over you? Now then, do it. Do it. Now it's interesting here, Abner, who seems to be a pretty godless person, invokes the name of the Lord a couple of times here. "For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel out of the hands of the Philistines and out of the hands of all their enemies. And Abner also spoke in the ears of Benjamin," specifically mentions Benjamin here, the leaders of the pro-Saul, pro-Ishbosheth Benjamites, "and Abner went also to speak in the ears of David in Hebron." So he went to the elders of non-Jewish Israel, he went to the leaders of Benjamin, and he went to David and said basically the same thing to all of them. "All that seemed good to Israel, and that seemed good to the whole house of Benjamin." Again, Saul's family and other non-Saulite Benjamites. Verse 20, "So Abner came to David to Hebron in person now, and 20 men with him. And David made Abner and the men that were with him a feast." You've got to think about this, you know. Abner was one of David's worst enemies before this. "And Abner said unto David, I will arise and go," and you repeat the word "I" if you want, "I will gather all Israel unto my Lord the King." So now, you know, a couple of minutes ago, or a little while ago, Ishbosheth was Abner's king, and now he's calling David my Lord the King, and he is saying that he's going to do this, he's going to put this together, "and will gather all Israel unto my Lord the King, that they may make a league with you, a treaty with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires." And once again, in this statement, we see more than just a hint of Abner's arrogance. So there's a big question here, and a huge question, and that is, was Abner sincere? Was Abner sincere in this apparent change of loyalty from Ishbosheth to David? To David, who even so very recently had been their enemy, their number one enemy? Or was Abner just playing both sides? Was he playing both sides in order to fulfill his own selfish, ambitious goals? And Joab suspected that. Joab, David's top general, would soon suggest that this approach of Abner's was a treacherous precursor to a planned attempt to usurp David's power, as well as Ish-bosheth's power as well. Now, was this approach, was it a precursor? Was he going to, well, we probably never know, not in this life anyway, because Abner's intentions were soon to be abruptly cut short. Still in verse 21. Look at the repetition here as we go through these verses. And David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop, probably a troop of Philistines, and brought in a great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron. He'd already gone. It says he went. He was gone in peace. When Joab and all the host that was with him were come, they told Joab, saying, "Hey, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he sent him away, and he's gone in peace." Imagine the shock of Joab. And Joab came to the king, to David, and said, "What have you done? What have you done? Behold, Abner came unto you. Why is it that you have sent him away, and he is quite gone? You know Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you, and to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you do." So Joab was emboldened here to say these words to his king, because he knew that his nemesis, Abner, had been one of David's worst enemies. And Joab strongly suspected that now this proffered peace treaty of Abner's was likely a mere ploy to get into David's good graces and to prevent just punishment on those who pursued David and his men and all of his people, and also to spy on David's intentions. Why? Likely so that he, Abner, could influence events, and again for his own ambitious ends. Well, it certainly looks that way. But there's another side to it as well. On the other hand, perhaps Joab, and remember, Joab had long been one of David's top right-hand men. Perhaps he feared, perhaps he was jealous of the possibility of Abner being promoted into his own position and taken over what he had as the top general. Again, the possibility of Abner, who Abner had been the right-hand man of Saul, and Joab so well knew that David had respected and loved Saul so much that David might promote Abner into his own position. So there's a certain amount of possible jealousy there. But Joab was Abner's equal in warlike tendencies. They were like two peas in a pod. And Joab was not going to sit around on his hands to wait for David's approval and to do absolutely nothing to prevent Abner's ambitions. So Joab took matters into his own hands, and he acted very swiftly. Verse 26. "And when Joab was come out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, which brought Abner back again from the well of Sirah, back to Hebron. But David knew it not. And when Abner was returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate," right in the city gates, "to," quote unquote, "speak with him quietly," supposedly anyway. "And Joab smote him there under the fifth rib, that he died. for the blood of Asahel his brother. And as we read back in chapter 2, Abner had killed Joab's brother Asahel in exactly the same way by smiting him under the fifth rib. Verse 28. And afterward, when David heard of it, he said, it's a little bit surprising here what's going backwards and forwards. David said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before the Lord forever from the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest, let the guilt rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house. And let there not fail from the house, this is a curse now, let there not fail from the house of Joab one who has an issue, or one that is a leper, or one that leans on a staff, probably blind, or that falls on the sword, or that lacks bread. This is quite a curse, a terrible curse. But again, we look at this, we read this, and we ask, who was the right and the wise one here in this matter? Was it David or Joab? And who was the wrong one and the unwise one? Let's go back to commentator John Gill on this question, because I tend to agree with what he wrote on this verse. This is a, let me quote here, this is from John Gill. He said, though it was a very wicked action in Joab to murder Abner in this manner, and for the reasons he did, yet it was a just vengeance from the Lord on Abner for fighting against God and for acting against the dictates of his own conscience, for his rebellion against David, and for the perfidy, which means treachery, to Ish-bosheth, and for having been the cause of much bloodshed in Israel. So again, Abner, we know, was certainly not lily white in God's eyes. So I tend to agree with John Gill in that I believe that the Lord's will certainly was being done here, and that if Abner would have lived on, he would have quickly become a huge stumbling block to David and to David's goal of a united Israel under his God-given Jewish monarchy. However, on the other hand, Abner did serve a purpose here. Abner's agreement with David and treaty with David probably was instrumental in paving the way for the unification between David's Jews and the other Israelite tribes. Verse 30. So Joab and Abishai his brother slew Abner because he had slain their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. Just two interesting details in that one verse, in verse 30. First of all, Joab was not alone in murdering Abner. Asahel's other brother, Abishai, was complicit in the murder as well. And secondly, technically, Abner, going back to when Abner killed Asahel, technically Abner did not actually murder Asahel. Rather, he killed him in the battle, and as we remember, in self-defense. Now, of course, we could have a long discussion as to what level of wartime killing does or does not constitute murder, but, you know, that's a big discussion for another day. So let's continue on, still in chapter 3, verse 31. And David said to Joab and to all the people that were with him, rend your clothes and gird you with sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David himself followed the bier, you know, the funeral bier. And this command of David's must have been a hard pill to swallow very hard command for Joab to obey, but we imagine he probably gritted his teeth and went along with it and complied for the ultimately greater good. Verse 32. And they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king David lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept. They used to do that in those days. If they, you know, if they loved the king and the king did something, they kind of followed suit. And all the people wept. And the king lamented over Abner and said, and this was in the form of a question now, died Abner as a fool dies? And then, as though he were speaking to Abner, in verse 34, your hands, Abner, were not bound, nor your feet put into fetters. No, Abner, you didn't die like that. You died like this. As a man falls before wicked men, so fell you. And all the people wept again over him. And when all the people came to cause David to eat meat, food, while it was still yet day, David swore, saying, so do God to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun be down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it was not of the king to slay Abner, the son of Ner. So it seems to have been very important to David to prove to all of the people, including the Benjamites, including all of the people of Judah and the non-Jewish people of Israel, that he had not ordered Abner's murder. That was important to him. Verse 38. And the king said unto his servants, know you not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? And I am this day weak, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, be too hard for me. You know, Joab and Abishai, they're too hard for me. And you look up the Hebrew word for the English word hard here, and it means rough. They're too rough for me, they're too cruel, they're hard hearted, they're heavy handed, they're severe and they're fierce. But also that same word can mean that they're stubborn, they're stiff necked, they're obstinate, and that it's impossible to keep them under control. Still in verse 39, the Lord shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness. That's important. Something that we can learn from, brethren. The Lord shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness. Eventually, so we know that Joab and Abishai did this, eventually, and much later, in our history, we're going to read about this later, Joab rebelled against David and when he supported one of his rebellious sons. And when that happened, David, who was an old man by then, was compelled to order Joab's death. But once again, coming back to this circumstance here, once again, we must ask the question, was David right or was he wrong in this level of lament over the death of Abner? Well, we look at this, and there's a couple of points to consider as we ask these questions. First of all, and there's no actual record of this, but it's quite possible, even probable, that David had been quite friendly with Abner back in the days when they both served Saul together at Saul's palace. You know, before Saul went squarely and poor David had to take off. So they might have been friendly back then. Secondly, David here called Abner a prince and a great man. So we know, obviously, Saul was the anointed king. And way back in 1 Samuel 14, you don't have to turn there, but Samuel recorded the fact that Abner was Saul's uncle, okay, which made Abner a prince. And you think about David's love for Saul, that anyone that was close to David's beloved Saul was also, to some extent, respected and loved by David. Okay? Alright, so now thirdly, the third thing that we need to consider here, that although the Lord, again, much later, judged David as having, I'll just quote what it says there, and this is in, you don't have to turn there, 1 Chronicles chapters 22 and 28, where the Lord judged David as having shed blood abundantly, and as having made great wars, and as having been a man of war. Still, other than contriving the death of Bathsheba's husband Uriah the Hittite, at heart, David was not a murderer, per se. And certainly at this point in time, he did not condone murder. We know that we've already seen the history so far that when he twice had the opportunity to murder Saul, who'd become his archenemy, David declined to do so. And he explained at the time that according to the Lord's will, Saul would meet his end in some other manner, which, of course, Saul did. Saul did meet in another manner. And perhaps David had similar thoughts regarding Abner, who, in his allegiance to Saul, had also become David's enemy. And his thoughts, perhaps, that if Abner was in fact hatching a plot against him, and if the Lord did judge Abner worthy of an early death, that he too would meet his end in some other manner. So, brethren, let's leave it there for today with the death. These are all very significant piece parts in the history of the Jews. Okay, so let's leave it there with the death of the once powerful Abner. But again, as we leave this for today, without Abner, we have to ask the question, and you know, without Abner, Abner may have eventually become a threat to David's monarchy, but without him, what would become of Abner's weakling puppet king Ish-bosheth, who, without Abner, now posed much less of a threat, virtually no threat at all to David? What would happen to him? Brethren, let's tune in again next week, same time, same channel, and we'll find out.